Good morning, ladies and gentlemen, and thank you very much, John, for that introduction. It is a very great pleasure for me indeed to participate in this IEEE Canadian Conference on Electrical and Computer Engineering, and to be able to visit St. John's for the first time. When my wife and I decided to get married back in the 60s, she was living in Canada and I in the United States. And so this part of the world, North America, holds many memories for us. We visited Canada many times, but never got as far east as St. John's. There are a number of links, historical links, that join the community in Newfoundland to that in England, and many of them have been referred to already today. I'd just like to mention a couple more. St. John's is the oldest city in North America, and the town where my university is located, Colchester in England, is the oldest recorded town in England. We have that in common, and it's nice to be able to link hands briefly on this occasion. We have another link through the work of Marconi. It was a great thrill for me yesterday to see the spot where radio messages were first received in this part of the world from England back at the turn of the century. The scene was quite dramatic against a backdrop of three icebergs out in the Atlantic, and I enjoyed it very much. Marconi, when he came to England, age 22, in 1896 from Italy, set up his operations in the county where my university is located, Essex. Can I have the first overhead? This is a historical shot of the first radio or wireless factory in the world, which he set up 3 years later in 1899 in Hall Street, Chelmsford, which is located about 25 miles south southwest of Colchester, where my university is. Of somewhat more interest to academics and perhaps a little less well known, can I have the next slide, please? There's the fact that Marconi set up the first wireless school in the world at Frinton-on-Sea, a little seaside village about 15 miles east of my university, in 1901. That mast is no longer there, but the houses are there, and if anybody's interested in the history of Marconi and of wireless telegraphy, you can visit that selfsame place at 34 Upper Third Avenue, and now there is a commemorative plaque on the left-hand house, which was actually used for the instruction. The people actually attending the school stayed in the right-hand house. The next overhead, please. Well, now to the the subject matter of my presentation this morning. Most of the talks which I give are about the technical aspects of multimedia, and I talk about the work which is going on in my research laboratory, where there are several members of academic staff and a number of research officers and students. But I'm conscious of the fact that this is a plenary lecture this morning, and that I ought, in terms of topic, to be a little more general. So I'm going to look at the future of multimedia, and in particular I'm going to try to answer question number 2, which is what strategy will lead to a maximum return on investment in this area. And this is not just a business question, it's a question for academics like myself as well. We have to apply for research funds, we have to think ahead and plan ahead in this field, and what kind of strategy will lead to a maximum return on the efforts that we put in. But being an academic, you'll have to forgive me for this, I need to ask a preliminary question, and that is it possible to say anything useful at all about the future of multimedia communication? So those are the two questions which I'd like to attempt to answer. And to do this, I would like to do two things. The first is to recount briefly my experiences as a member of the United Kingdom Technology Foresight Panel in communications. And then I'd like to go on to look at past growth patterns of some selected telecommunications services to see whether we can learn any lessons from these about the growth process itself. Next overhead, please. Well, the portrait is of Sir William Stewart, who was the Chief Scientific Advisor, Office of Science and Technology, reporting to the Cabinet. And this technology foresight exercise, which some of you may have heard of, took place between 1994 and 1995. Its origins were in the white paper, the 1993 white paper, Realizing Our Potential, which was very well received in the scientific and engineering community in the United Kingdom. So the aims of this exercise are briefly stated there. The United Kingdom has 1% of the world's population, 5% of the world's GDP, and supports 5% of the world's research. We therefore cannot do everything, although perhaps some people would like to. Was it possible, therefore, to come to some consensus among ourselves about technology developments over the next 20 years out to 2015 so that the country's R&D resources could be effectively deployed both for the benefit of the wealth and for the benefit of the quality of life of its citizens? So following the publication of the white paper, the government set up, through the Office of Science and Technology, 15 panels in key areas which were of importance and still are of importance to the United Kingdom. And I was a member of the communications panel, and that's the one I'm going to be reporting on. We had a sister panel, which was in information technology and electronics, with which we maintained contact. Next overhead, please. The methodology that was adopted was common to all panels and was quite an interesting one, as I found it. This was devised by a set of consultants to the Office of Science and Technology, and it had four stages. First of all, panels were asked to consider how society would develop out to 2015, what trends, issues, or driving courses were likely to shape technology development. Second, what new market opportunities would arise from these trends. Thirdly, what new products, processes, or services are likely to meet these opportunities. And finally, what are the technologies and engineering innovations, the theme of this conference, which were needed to support such products. So those questions were addressed by each of the panels. The panels were composed perhaps two-thirds of industrialists and perhaps one-third of academics like myself. There then was a stage of consultation in which we, panels as a whole, talked to about 10,000 individuals, mainly in the United Kingdom, but also abroad. We consulted all the major institutions, the Royal Society, the Institution of Electrical Engineers, and so on. And we held 60 regional workshops throughout the United Kingdom to solicit opinions as to what we ought to be doing. And finally, in the spring of 1995, each of the panels produced a report, and there was also an overarching report by the steering group. If I could just flip very quickly through the next three slides, this will just give you an impression of how we set about the identification of trends, issues, and driving causes. You can see these are the things that, in this specimen example, we asked people to fill in, and those were the four stages. And finally, through this process, beginning in society and extending through the market to technology, we would come up with some things which we felt that were worth supporting. Now, all that was 2 years ago, and I think perhaps it's time to reflect a little bit on what we achieved. I don't particularly want to go into the detail of what my panel recommended. These reports are available through the Office of Science and Technology. But I think it's time for a little reflection. My first reflection is that, on the whole, I thought that we reached some sensible conclusions in communications, which are now being acted on. One of them I quote here, Digital superhighways can only be justified by the demand for services which will be provided over them. Insufficient attention is being given to the content of such services because there is too much emphasis on technological questions, such as whether all homes and businesses in the UK should be connected to an optical fibre network. And we recommended to the government's funding body, the Engineering and Physical Sciences Research Council, that more be made available for multimedia networking, and that now has been acted upon. We also recognised that the university effort in telecommunications was dispersed rather widely in the United Kingdom, and we recommended that virtual centres of excellence be set up. That has been acted on, and I'm very pleased that my particular group at Essex, in a competitive process, has been accepted into the Virtual Centre of Excellence in Digital Broadcasting and Multimedia. So that's the first reflection. The second reflection is that I have to admit, looking back, and this is just a personal view, that it really was very difficult for us to foresee more than a couple of years ahead, and certainly not clearly out to 2015. Quite a lot of our time was taken up discussing regulatory issues within the United Kingdom, and I think that we really recognise, and I certainly recognise looking back, that the future is extremely difficult to predict in the long term. It is not only the inventions of the future which are difficult to predict, the inventions which have not yet been made, but is the way in which people react to those inventions, the way that they are accepted in society, that is extraordinarily difficult to predict. We are, in fact, faced by perhaps not a completely random or stochastic process, but something that's near stochastic in its nature. The third reflection that I have is that I did not feel in the timescale that was set by the Office of Science and Technology that there was really enough time for us, with all the consultation that we engaged in through various Delphi processes and so on, to develop views on what factors contribute to the success of some multimedia or monomedia services and the failure of others. And if we look back in time, we see that there have been enormous successes. Telephony and entertainment radio and television are truly ubiquitous. But there have been failures as well. The early videotech services and video phones, the various attempts to get the video phone off the ground, have not succeeded. And I became quite interested, and have been interested since, in the basic driving forces and factors which shape success and failure in this area. Would it be possible, by studying the past history of successes and failures, to say just a little more than, well, you might as well throw darts at a dartboard or roll a die to find out what you ought to be doing in terms of your research, so that you could increase the probability that you would succeed. Next overhead, please. Well, I come now to the question of what drives developments in multimedia, and I don't think that we all agree on this, and certainly in the United Kingdom we don't all agree, because on the networking side there are people who very fiercely argue, perhaps rightly, that what is going to shape the future of multimedia is the development of appropriate networks. And it has become a subject, a very huge subject in itself, a fascinating subject where very many distinguished people are involved. It's developed a momentum of its own so that the current scene in telecommunications historically seems to me to be different from that in the past, where these networks are being designed well in advance of the services they are intended to carry. But if we look back, we see that the train was invented before the railway network, the motor car was invented before the road network, the telephone was invented before the telephone network, television was invented before the television distribution network, and the computer was invented before the computer network. And each of these networks has different characteristics matched to the traffic it carries. If we build networks to cater to unknown and unspecifiable future traffic, the risk is that we might get it wrong. And I remember the confident predictions made 15, 20 years ago about the spread of ISDN into the home. Maybe that will happen now and maybe it won't, but certainly is behind schedule. And maybe it'll be replaced by demand via ADSL, which has better matching capabilities to certain multimedia services. Okay, next overhead, please. What I'd like to do now, and what I've been doing with my students over the last few years, is specifically to attend to some very common services. Telephony, radio, and television are very common services. For those of you interested in this subject, I can thoroughly recommend, if you've not already read, Claude Fisher's book, America Calling, A Social History of the Telephone. Many of my colleagues on the Technology Foresight panel were not aware of this book until I pointed it out, but it's a marvelously insightful account of the social development of the telephone, with particular case studies in California. And it's conducted by a professional sociologist who's at University of California, Berkeley. And abstracting a little from Claude Fisher's studies, it does seem as if the cost of a service relative to a person's income is a key factor in the service subscription. If you look at the growth of the telephone, somewhat slow at first, then accelerating, a dip caused by the Great Depression, and then an accelerated increase. But overall, perhaps a century or more to reach 100% penetration. Radio and television, much more rapid. If we look out in space today to countries with a low GDP, such as China and India, we can almost look back in time. It's like these things, space and time and astronomy, because what some countries are like today, we were like a century ago. And certainly, if you relate the growth of telephony to GDP, you come across an approximate constant in the growth factor. Now, the difference between telephony and radio and television I've just referred to, there is another thing we need to note, that with conversational services, growth can be slow at first because there are not enough subscribers, a critical mass with whom to converse. One of the very interesting things, however, which I learned from Claude Fisher's study, which I didn't wholly appreciate, was this. When I was at Bell Labs, I many times heard the technological history of the telephone, remarkable as it is. But what I hadn't realized is that it took telephone engineers a generation to establish that there was a market for telephony other than the one that they had first conceived of. Their first conceptions, and I think this is true of engineers, of us engineers, is that we invent things for sometimes rather simplistic reasons, often as a replacement technology, in this particular case, perhaps for the telegraph. And whereas it was imagined that telephony would serve business purposes and emergency purposes in society, what was not fully realized back in the last century was that it could provide a means for social conversation. And if I could have the next overhead, which is his book, it was around about a generation after the telephone had been invented that the marketing people realized that you could sell the telephone for social reasons, for social conversation. So it was a piece of technology, a remarkable piece of technology, which was invented perhaps for one reason and then found another usage. And I think that returns me to the point that I made at the beginning of my address, that it makes it quite difficult to predict how a particular service is going to be taken up. Next overhead, please. These are some curves of the growth of radio and television in the United Kingdom, as judged by the number of licenses which are issued in the United Kingdom. You need a license to listen to the radio or to watch television, at least BBC. And what we can see from this is another interesting factor in the growth of services, and that is that people would pay for increased realism, what we would now, I think, in 1997 technology call presence, over the course of time. So whereas radio conjured up certain images in your mind, and some radio presenters were able to do that extraordinarily well and artistically, nevertheless, when television came along and added sight, and later when color television came along and added color, people were prepared to pay for these improvements in realism. Next overhead, please. The history of this subject of service growth is full of interest, and one of the most interesting is that of facsimile. Facsimile was patented in 1843, but received only low-level usage for over a century until the late 1970s, when it suddenly took off. And I think it's necessary for us students of the subject to try to explain why that happened. Now, there is obviously a critical mass phenomenon with facsimile. You can't transmit faxes to people unless other people have compatible fax machines, so one has to say that. One also notes that over the course of time, there has been advance in the ease of use, the convenience of the technology through standardization, through the use of flatbed scanners, and through data compression. Time taken to transmit a fax page has been reduced from perhaps 12 or 6 minutes down to less than 1 minute today, and of course it can be done faster if you go to higher bit rates. And finally, we have to note that there has been a gradual lowering of the real cost of a telephone call until fax became competitive with the postal service. Next overhead, please. An even more interesting subject for students of this area is the videophone. And this was the videophone that was developed when I worked at Bell Labs. I wasn't directly involved in it, but there was a lot of excitement about it at the time. Next overhead, please. And worldwide, there was a similar development of analog videophones, typically with perhaps 256 by 256 picture elements, monochrome, with around about a 1 megahertz access bandwidth required. This particular one is by the UK Post Office at the time, and they are, of course, the British Telecom. Next overhead, please. This is a little bit of history in that there was an economic study made, a prediction made of the growth of the video phone by a well-known British company, which shall remain nameless. And as you can see, around about 1970, they were predicting exponential growth to 1985 of 1,850,000 number of instruments in the United Kingdom. Well, the actual number of instruments is much closer to the final digit in that row of 7 digits there. Next overhead, please. The videophone is a concept which seems to be reinvented by each generation of young engineers. In fact, it has quite a long history. Some of the very early experiments in television in the US were along the lines of face-to-face conversation. If you go to the PTT Museum in Berlin, they have a marvellous exhibition of a videophone which was used in the 1930s, before World War II, to connect Berlin and Leipzig. It's replete with Nipkow scanning discs and lighting arrangements, and its size is about from here to the end of the bench over there. It's really a massive piece of engineering. Well, it didn't take off then. It didn't take off in the 1960s and 1970s when there was a big effort. And now in the 1990s, people have added color, data compression's got better, and companies like BT are marketing this particular video phone. There's one by AT&T, and I think others are doing the same thing. But still, there's not much sign of growth in this area. Next overhead, please. And people like Michael Knowles, perhaps you know, are calling it a flop that won't die. Next overhead. So there's the 1970 prediction, which wasn't true, and the actual one on the bottom. So as I said, this is really interesting to consider why this service has not grown. One has to note that video telephony is a service, a conversational service, that requires a switch network, and that adds to the cost of the service, and it requires a critical mass of subscribers. But from all the studies that have taken place, I think that we have to say that the role of vision in telecommunications is complex, and it is still not well understood. One of the things that's interesting for us engineers to consider is that the introduction of the telephone was in fact a negative video phone, in the sense that prior to the introduction of the telephone, people had face-to-face vision when they conversed. The telephone took that away. And yet, as Fisher's studies have shown, people thought at the time that it was nevertheless possible to have an authentic conversation despite the absence of vision. So it does seem to me that the absence of need is a key factor in explaining the video phone. It may be cost, it may be engineering to some extent, but I think we have to look deeply at this question of need. Next overhead. Well, let's try to pull this together and to try to answer these two questions which I posed at the beginning. First of all, is it possible to say anything useful at all about the future of multimedia communication? Well, the thesis that I'm advancing is that the future is going to depend on very complex interactions between the social behavior of human beings and new technology, some of it yet to be invented. The social behavior of new human beings is perhaps easier to predict than the technology or the interaction. Human beings are likely to be behaving in 2015 very much the same as we behave now. They'll be being born, they'll be going to school, going to college, getting married, having kids, and working for a living. But the new technology is going to make a difference. Just how is very, very difficult indeed to predict. So turning to question two, what should we do in these circumstances? There are many, many confident people that we find around, you know as many as I do, who are quite certain that this particular technology is going to take off and this one won't. But I think that one has to say that the evidence is that none of us know for sure whether anything is going to take off or not. So under these circumstances, should we just rely on chance and serendipity to shape the future? Should we just respond to the seat of our pants rather than something that goes on up in our head and go for the technology that we believe is going to succeed, ignore the others, and admit that we may be wrong and it may be a waste of money? Or is there any other technique that we could use that will perhaps increase the chances of success? Well, it does appear from a study of these past services, a brief sample of which I have presented, is that yes, there are some things, some guiding principles in this area. And it's a little like Benjamin Graham's famous study of the stock market. We need not to be able to, not to try to predict the future of multimedia, nor to predict the future of the stock market, but to look for inherent value in what we do. And it does seem as if inherent value lies in a number of factors. I wouldn't, at this particular stage in our studies, wish to list them all, but need or use is an important one. I'll say just a few more words about that in a moment. Low cost is a very important factor. Ease of use or convenience is an important factor. And realism is another. So, how does that translate into practice? Well, if somebody wants to put all their effort in their particular research lab or their company into super high definition video phones, 2048 by 2048 by 60 hertz video phones, according to this analysis, that would be high risk. In my own laboratory, we're working on super high definition images, but we're not thinking of applying them to video phones. Why is it a high risk? Well, just coming down to this little diagram at the bottom, this was something put together by one of my students, Malcolm Macmillan. He actually tried to order these factors that I've referred to, and cost and need are the most important. Realism and ease of use, perhaps less so. So that's a little balance there. If the cost is too high of any particular project, the balance comes down on the right-hand side and you have a failure. The service fails to take off. If the need is high, the human need is high for this particular service, if it provides good realism and if it's easy to use, and if it can be provided at low cost, there is a chance, an increased chance, that it will take off. So applying these principles, it would appear that lower cost entertainment television with enhanced presence would have a lower risk of failure and a higher risk of success. And could I just finally illustrate this point by reference to some current work in my own laboratory? This work has been carried out with funding from the European Commission. The association that we have is with broadcasters in Europe, particularly with the Independent Television Commission in the UK. Our university is involved, the Italian broadcasters are involved, and the interesting thing about this particular study is a joint study between professional engineers and professional psychologists to try to establish need in this area. So TAPESTRIES is an acronym for the Application of Psychological Evaluation to Systems and Technologies in Remote Imaging and Entertainment Services. Next overhead, please. Fairly recently, in a previous European project, we, in association with partners in Europe, developed a new method, which has now been standardized by the ITU, for continuous assessment of the quality of digital television pictures. Next overhead, please. This technique involves subjects moving a lever, this is one of the ones we've experimented with, up and down as the digital quality varies, as it does if you're working using MPEG-2, for example, into a CBR channel. Next overhead. This is the sort of trace that you get. We recorded this a few months ago. On the left-hand side, you'll see quality vertically and time horizontally. And this is the average of 15 subjects' response. We get good agreement between subjects. And we get good agreement between different research labs, between ourselves and those in the Netherlands and so on. And in France, CCETT also involved. And the results can be expressed as a histogram. I've argued elsewhere, and I won't go into this today, that the negative tail of that histogram is quite significant. But if I go to the next overhead, please. These are some recent results from tapestries in which we're trying to establish need in the broadcast domain. So the broadcasters see digital television as providing an opportunity to deliver stereo to the home, where in the future it is envisaged that head-mounted displays will proliferate and perhaps the quality will improve. And this is a study by Jonathan Freeman, who's a young psychologist working in our group, of presence with stereo displays. Not the conventional virtual reality type of display, which is generated from a computer, though we're interested in those, but these are actually filmed professionally by companies specializing in this area to provide two digital tracks, high-quality digital tracks, which are fed to each eye. And one of the things you can see there, this is just a trace of presence and its correlates of depth. We're trying to understand the engineering correlates which would actually increase your feeling of being present in the scene. So when you have the strong sense of presence, your entertainment is presumably increased, and the broadcasters are quite interested in the design of such systems where presence is maximized. So you can see in the first part of the sequence that this was delivered in mono to subjects. The stereo was switched off, and then the stereo switched on around about frame 400, and the sense of presence that people have increases very rapidly and remarkably. But it's more complex than that, in that it interacts, the sense of presence interacts with the content of the scene. So if I could go back to the conclusion slide, that was just a little illustration of this final point of deciding where you're going to concentrate your effort. And given that you want to watch what the preacher does and not listen to what he says, this is actually what we're doing at the present time. John, thank you.